welcome once again to A Novel Evening. I'm Danny. You can find me over on Instagram and TikTok as at A Novel Evening Podcast. And this week, I'm going to be joined by Hope C. Tarr, who is going to chat to me all about her novel Irish Eyes, book one in the American Songbook series. This is a story. It's a true romance. It's a historical romance. It is set at the era of the Spanish-American War. It's all about finding roots, building new homes, second chances. If you love a story that's going to take you on a journey with a good ending, we'll just say that, this is the one for you. I cannot wait to chat to Hope all about her inspiration behind this story, where this idea came from, and the research that she did into this. I'm super, super excited. So let's welcome Hope onto the podcast. So a huge hello to Hope. Hello.
Hello. So how happy to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Where are you calling me from? I can't place it.
We are in New York.
Ah.
But I am currently, we are based in New York, but I'm currently at a beach house on the Jersey Shore.
Oh. It looks lovely, but I can't look out if it's daylight or if you've got a light on. Because I was like, it looks really sunny where you are.
Well, it is really sunny. It's only 3 p.m. here for me. So no, it's a beautiful, cold, wintry February day. And we'll have to warm up with some heavy book talk.
Yes. What's your favorite thing about living in New York? Because I live in a very small English town, and New York, for me, I've got a lot of images of what it's like. I've never been. So as a New Yorker, what's your favorite thing?
That's a great question. So I've been in New York since 2008. I think my favorite thing is walking out the door of my apartment and never really knowing what interesting conversation I may overhear or be part of. I love getting on the subway and hearing 5 different languages being spoken in the same car sometimes. I just love the melting pot of people. I met my husband in New York. I love it so much, but you know, where you live is lovely as well. I took a wonderful hiking trip with my then boyfriend, to Cornwall. So I was Devon adjacent.
You were in Cornwall. Is beautiful.
It was gorgeous. We hiked the coastal pathway, and we did some inland hiking, and it was just absolutely stunning. So I like the mix of city and rural.
What I love, I think, as well for you guys and for us in comparison is kind of how different the histories are. You know, you can come out where we are and you walk past ancient castles that are, you know, hundreds of years old. And I feel like your history, especially in New York, is almost like fast tracked. So much has happened in such a short space of time. I feel like for us, our history is quite long and not a lot has changed in some ways in some places in England. It still looks, there's still some shops from Tudor times still open. And for you guys, I feel like it's so fast-tracked. Your history has happened so rapidly.
I mean, I think that's a great point. And New York especially is constantly reinventing itself. Yeah. I mean, literally, you can walk down a street and see a building there, and then the next week it's gone, which is sometimes a little alarming for me. I'm a big history buff, and I love old buildings. So I'm not always with the pace of the city's progress, but I can see, even since I moved there in the mid-aughts, it's in many ways a very different city.
And is there anywhere in the UK you'd really like to come back to and visit?
Oh, so many places. I would love to go back and stay in Richmond. That was our last stay a few years ago when we visited. We did the hiking trip in Cornwall and had a few days in London, and I had friends who were living in Teddington, and we had an amazing dinner. And I just, the whole Richmond Hill and the towpath, the Thames towpath, I love that area. My ambition is, before I get too rickety and old, to hike the Thames towpath.
Amazing.
We'll see if I can get that done.
Oh, fingers crossed. So we had a little chat before we started recording about Irish Eyes, your novel, and the kind of journey you've been on. This is quite a long process for you from the start of the book to now. So let's delve in a little bit to, firstly, where did the idea for Irish Eyes come from? Let's tell people a little bit of the story and what they're going to be picking up.
Great. So I'll start with the idea. So as some of you know, or some maybe don't know, I had written romance novels prior to Irish Eyes. I had done 20 books for Harlequin, Penguin, and some other presses. And I love those books, and some of them were historicals, but for a long time I had started to feel restless. It was almost as if my writing career was a pair of beloved old jeans that just didn't seem to fit anymore. And so I was on a hiking trip, speaking of hiking, to Western Ireland, and it was, even for Ireland, is very rainy the first day of the trip and tough. And so they piled us into a bus and took us to the Cliffs of Moher. One of those tourist spots you have to tick off. And I remember going up to the overlook and looking out, and the mist parted, and I saw this trio of islands that I later learned was the Aran Islands. And my heroine Rose O'Neill's story began to take shape for me. And then when I came back to New York, I was living, in the city, would be running along the Battery Park, running pa biking path. Look out and you see the Statue of Liberty. And so all of this, kind of connected the story that started to take place in Ireland to New York. And, my own Irish ancestry is important to me. And I really wanted to write a book that was sort of an epic, sweeping historical saga, like a Catherine Cookson novel of yore. And those books just didn't really seem to be prevalent anymore. And so I embarked on writing Rose's story. And as you know, Irish Eyes is the story of Rose O'Neill, who immigrates from Inishmore, the largest of the three Aran Islands, in 1898. And she comes to New York in search of the Yank soldier who swore to marry her. And then she finds out, of course, that he and the city are not exactly what she thought they would be. So we have 24 years in the life of this woman. There's, I think, a pretty yummy love triangle at the heart of her story. But it's also really about finding yourself, about pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. She lives through so many of the Spanish-American War in 1898, where her brother dies. World War I, Prohibition, and the Speakeasy era. And so it's just a really fun way, I hope, to introduce a lot of readers to turn of the century and early 20th century American and Irish American history.
Love that. I love that. And that was a real time of very rich kind of history as well. My parents live in Ireland, actually, as well. I laughed when you said about it being so wet. They live in Cork. It's always wet.
Okay.
So whenever we
Yes.
visited, I'm like, oh, it's so, but that's why it's so beautiful. That is why. And there is obviously in New York such a rich history of Irish immigration coming into New York as well. I mean, even now, I think people are very proud of their Irish heritage all across the states, right? If they come from families who have moved from Ireland, it surprises me how kind of prevalent it is within communities.
It's very much so. I mean, for instance, I said at the beginning when we started to chat that I'm staying at the Jersey Shore right now. And part of the Jersey Shore adjacent to where I'm staying is known as the Irish Riviera. So we're probably more excited about St. Patrick's Day here than folks in Ireland are. It's
You guys do make a
everybody's
way bigger deal
Irish.
of it. I've seen some of the like green beer
I don't know. I don't
is
know.
is I'm like incredible because I definitely like
I have two St. Patrick's Day parades scheduled for next month, and there may be a third. I mean, everybody's a little Irish in March, and I think that's great fun. And yes, people are terribly proud of their Irish ancestry, which is so interesting because initially when Irish immigrants came to cities like New York and whatnot, I mean, there were no Irish need apply signs. They were really not met with a lot of welcome. And in sort of the timeless cycle of new groups coming in and facing these walls, what they did was they made their own community. You have Tammany Hall, which I talk about quite a bit in the book, was really providing that infrastructure for at first Irish immigrants and then immigrants later on from other countries in Europe to find their footing in the city, to find jobs, to enter politics, to enter the fire department. The fire department at the turn of the century in New York was an incubator for political careers.
Wow.
So a lot of, in fact, Tammany Hall's mascot, the Tammany Tiger, came from Engine Company Number 6.
Oh,
So
really?
all these kind of fun puzzle pieces that started to fit together as I was researching the book.
And you mentioned to me earlier that, this was a 15-year journey for you. That's a huge amount of time from kind of this little seed of an idea through to your book being published. What was kind of the most challenging thing for you? Was it the research? Was it kind of finding this story and getting its feet? What was kind of the challenge for you over that period?
I think, yeah, in terms of the book, I mean, the research was all-encompassing. I wouldn't say it was difficult because I'm such a history geek, always been such a nerd, and not just American history, but British history and recently Indian history. So that part was, I guess, it was knowing when to stop, and
Yeah.
also just really, the trickiest part was finding a publisher.
Right.
People were not keen on a big book.
Right.
I don't think the book is vast, but it is
No,
more
I
than
wouldn't say,
100,000 words.
considering what I've just read an app a 900 page like tome.
But
That's.
no. I mean, it's a pretty, it's still a pretty quick read, but it was just sort of, people, I think, in publishing go through cycles, as we all go through cycles, and it was so trying to meet the moment with this book that didn't clearly fit into the box, any of the boxes. It's a saga. It spans 24 years. It's talking about Irish history, which people are excited about, but waxes and wanes in terms of what people are looking for. So that was really the 15-year journey part of it. And I'm so grateful for those 15 years. Certainly I was working on other projects, but I really, in writing this book, stretched myself as a writer and as just a creative in general. And I don't think that's ever a bad thing.
No, and it's found its right home as well. I guess that's the important thing, is when you find the right place for your book, the wait is worth it when you find somewhere where it fits.
Exactly so. So the book came out with Loom Jaffe Books in December, and I have a wonderful editor there and a wonderful team, and they seem to really, really get the book and know how to position it, which is, of course, so important.
Yeah. And I find it very interesting when you're saying about kind of things that wax and wane. I love historical fiction, particularly Tudor historical fiction. And there was a point where there was so much Tudor fiction coming out, so much of it. And actually, with your book, this is a time period that I was very unfamiliar with, even with my own kind of Irish background. As I say, my family come from Ireland. It's not something I know a great deal about woefully. And I certainly didn't know anything about the Spanish-American War. What was it that kind of brought you to bring that into the story? How did you kind of link that into it?
Thank you. That's a great question. So the Spanish-American War was really a fairly brief conflict. I think it was a 10-month span, and it
Wow.
was basically a reaction of the United States at the time to Spain's possession of Cuba and the Philippines. And so, this is where you have the legends of Teddy Roosevelt and the former US president, on the Rough Riders and the Charge of San Juan Hill, and there's so much kind of lore about it. I was really interested to, to read for myself what it was all about. And I read first person diaries of soldiers who were in the war. And of course, it's 1898, so you do have silent film. So there's some film documentaries of it, very
Right.
short, that you could see on YouTube and the like. But I was always also really looking for something to kind of bring the characters together in a way that didn't feel contrived. And so the heroine's brother, who emigrated to the US 8 years prior to the book starting, volunteers to fight in the war. And he meets this tough, if you will, this American, son of an American mogul, and they end up fighting together in the war, serving together in the war. And then that is the catalyst for one of my main male characters, Adam Blakely, to meet Rose on Inishmore. But I thought it was just really interesting. I have an ancestor, a great 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 uncle who fought in the Spanish-American War, who was also an immigrant. He was a German immigrant to the US. And I thought it was so interesting how people would emigrate at that time and then be so quickly patriotic. I
Yeah.
mean, there was no draft for the Spanish-American War. I mean, especially in New York, I mean, you could choose, no one was making you sign up. There was no conscription for it. So it was so interesting My relative was wounded, not mortally, came back and actually ended up with a he had a wound in his arm and couldn't work for a while and was on out of work, and his family suffered for that. And I thought it was really interesting. And I also think that the Spanish-American War, you're starting to hear more people talking about it now than you did, even a few years ago. People, the press, the American press so touted it as,
Right.
we're going to go to Cuba, we're going to run these Spaniards out, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And it was really Randolph Hearst who wanted to sell a lot of newspapers. That's where you have the Newsies strike, the Newsboy strike. So, it was basically conflict and wars, sell newspapers. So, the press was really promoting this as, as though Spain was going to take over America. They were saying
Right.
that the Spanish had blown up one of our ships, the USS Maine, which probably it wasn't true. And so all of these young men were flocking to join the fight, and it was almost like they were going to some kind of a club or a party. And then, of course, once they got to Cuba, I mean, it, miserable conditions. More people probably died of yellow fever and malaria than they did of bullet wounds.
Right.
But, as anybody who lives through something like that, they came home changed.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I address, I hope with a light touch and Irish eyes, is, my hero Adam dealing with, PTSD, as we would say today, or combat stress syndrome, as they used to say years ago. Nobody talked about that then, and there were no support groups. But I think it's important to show those types of things and show people surviving them.
Yeah, absolutely. And the time period I do love to read about is the Prohibition. And as well, kind of the Roaring 20s in New York is so quintessential, I think. How was it for you to capture that kind of spirit? Because I think it's so iconic as well, that kind of Prohibition, that time people all know so well, I think, and we all have images of. How was it for you to kind of capture that moment?
Well, I mean, the short answer is so much fun. The Prohibition lasted, I think, 11 years in this country. I mean,
Wow.
it was a huge, huge time period. And I deal with it a bit in the context of Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall was the Democratic political party machine in New York. And so the Democrats were known as the wet party then, meaning, the booze and whiskey and beer flowed.
Yep.
And the Republicans at the time were known, as, the dry party. So, more puritanical, and certain political leaders were always trying, Republican political leaders were always trying to shut down the saloons in New York, and German and Irish immigrants and others didn't really care for that so much. So they tended to be Democrats, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's such an interesting era that we're still unpacking. There's so many, speakeasy styled bars that flourish in New York to this day. And I think it really goes to speak to human nature. And if you want to stop something, the very last thing to do sometimes is make it illegal. Because people, all they wanted to do was drink and go to the pub, after working a 6.5 day work week, let's go to the pub for the men at least, not the women. Women couldn't go, but then the men would go to what they called the saloons. It was a very different culture to Ireland, where pubs were more of a family affair. And they would blow off some steam, and then they would get up with a sore head on Monday morning and do it all over again. But it's such a rich and fun time period, and with so many ramifications that we're still unpacking. I mean, the whole flight of the bright young things to Paris. Hemingway, and you have Sylvia Beach at Shakespeare and Company, and you have the F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda. I mean, that the part of it was Paris had a low cost of living, and you could get a drink there. We basically had a mass exodus of some of the best minds of the earliest 20th century, because they it was illegal to have a drink here.
Was there anything when you were doing your research that really kind of surprised you? Was there anything you learned that was kind of unexpected to tie into your book?
A lot of things I thought I had a handle on, and perhaps had maybe more of a surface knowledge of, were unpacked for me in the process of researching this. I think just overall an appreciation for how one changing one thing sets off often this chain reaction. You know, for example, you know, to the point of prohibition, prior to the Volstead Act, which was the amendment to the U.S. Constitution that prohibited the sale of alcohol. There were all of these other efforts. There was a Republican senator called named Claude Rains, who in New York got the Rains Law enacted. And the Rains Law basically said that no saloon could serve alcohol. You had to be a hotel. So if you were a saloon, you had to get a hotelier's license.
I can imagine that was droves of hotels suddenly opening.
Suddenly, New York is full of these small boutique hotels, and you also had to serve food. So these, you know, these saloons would, you know, typically there were a couple rooms over top where staff slept or whatever. They opened them as rooms for let. The food menu requirement could be, you know, saltine crackers and slices of raw onion, as McSorley still serves to this day. And so what it basically did, it didn't stop anyone from drinking. It just proliferated prostitution.
Right.
Alcohol, room above the stairs, you know, it's all the ingredients of a perfect storm.
Yeah.
So that was just kind of a fun fact that, you know, I wouldn't have known about that I learned in the course of the book.
I think that's so fascinating. And also, I think it speaks, you know, a testament to the willfulness of business owners as well, then, that they were going to find ways around these laws. And I mean, you know, prohibition itself, they all found ways around it. It didn't
exactly
go away entirely.
So. And I mean, not to be excessively cynical, but I mean, what ended prohibition basically was the Great Depression. And the US government was like, wait a minute, we could be getting a sin tax from selling all of this booze. I know you had Nancy Bilyeu on not too long ago, September. And, you know, Nancy made a point, and she's quite right. Prohibition really was the origin of the mafia in the United States. You know, so, you know, you take a controlled substance like alcohol out of the government's hands, you make it illegal, and then who's going to move it? You know, criminals. So,
yeah, exactly. And it's almost like the government realized, hang on a minute, they're getting money from this. We could be doing that.
Could have a cut. We could have a cut.
Oh, so. It's so interesting. You say it's kind of like one little drop and makes all these ripples into something bigger. And my last question about your book before we move on to what comes next is, Rose is a character. What is your favorite thing about Rose? What did you most enjoy about writing her character?
She absolutely, absolutely never gives up on her vision. She has a larger vision of herself and her life than others may have for her the moment she steps off the ocean liner into New York Harbor. She absolutely just forges ahead. And I think that spirit is so much of what we need to be celebrating more today. I think that, you know, it's also very realistic. I mean, I read an awful lot of diaries of immigrants who went through Ellis Island. You know, my own ancestors. I mean, that sort of stick-to-itiveness and just intrepid spirit is what made America America. And I mean, I think that's something to be celebrated. And I love that about her. That doesn't mean that she doesn't experience, you know, downs. She deals with a lot of tragedy, personal tragedy in the book, and always seems to somehow find her way to the other side of it.
Yeah.
I would like to be more like that. So she, you know, she's sort of a, you know, a beacon, I think, of, because she is a composite of so many real people who lived during that time. I think she can be a beacon of light for me, and I hope for other people who read it.
I mean, for me on a personal level, my great-grandmother came over from Ireland. She moved to Dorset in England to marry a man who already had a child, to help raise the child, and had children of her own. There's not a great deal known about her, sadly. I don't know many stories about her, but I do know that the expectations for young women within Ireland, within kind of, I would say probably the UK as a whole, but especially in Ireland because of such a kind of rigid religious structure as well, the expectations of young women to married, to follow a husband, to, be wed and have children in wedlock, to produce, especially in Catholic families, quite a lot of children. If your husband was to emigrate, you were to follow him dutifully. But for a young woman to emigrate alone, and we obviously learn in the book quite early on that she's expecting a baby, to be an unwed single mother moving away was huge for that time period for a young Irish woman, where expectations would be fairly low as to what you would kind of achieve in your life, is a huge thing.
No, absolutely. I actually just been reading a little bit about the Magdalene laundries in Ireland, which is I had not realized that they extended into even I think the 1980s. I mean, it's amazing. Yes, your options were so few, and I mean, certainly you can see with that kind of a rigid framework why you would keep a pregnancy secret as long as you could, an unwed pregnancy.
There's actually a Cillian Murphy has just done a film, actually, I think is due out very soon, about kind of the Magdalene Laundries. And I think it is set relatively towards kind of the 70s, the 80s. I could be wrong, but I think it's around that time period. I also didn't, we did a play about it at school, and I didn't realize that it really did carry on a long way into, the 80s. It's really shocking. It was a huge deal. And for Rose, that's a life-changing thing. And I think it speaks
Very
a
much
lot to her.
so.
She chose her, her baby, and chose a much harder, I mean, the Magdalene Laundries, losing your child in the way they did, but it was a much harder path to be, and even coming over to America to be an unwed pregnant woman in a place you don't know, with, no idea if the father of the baby is going to do right by you, is very tough.
No, very much so. With no support structure and net of safety.
Definitely. So what comes next? So we know this book one, as we've seen in the book one of. So what comes next? Well, if you can tell me anything.
Of course. So Irish Eyes is the launch of my American Songbook series. And so every book is titled or will be titled in concert with a song from the sort of a musical canon of America over the time. So Irish Eyes is a song. The second book, which I'm working on as we speak, is Stardust, and that is set in New York and World War II Paris.
Okay.
So yeah, so Rose's granddaughter Daisy goes to Paris in 1938 to apprentice with Coco Chanel on Rue Cambon.
Oh, okay.
And it's meant to be a 8 month sort of apprenticeship. And of course the German army, the Nazi army, invades. They occupy Paris for 4 years. And Daisy initially decides to stay for reasons I'm not going to say, but there's a love interest. And then, of course, once America joins the war and is no longer officially neutral, she's trapped there. But she ends up being drawn into this fascinating cast of characters who congregate across the street from Maison Chanel at the Ritz Hotel. So,
Oh, you've got some fun places to play with
so
here.
much fun, so much fun. So, right, we've got the Hotel Ritz, we've got a rich tapestry of still American expats. We've got Josephine Baker there, we've got Sylvia Beach of Shakespeare and Company, just bored American socialites who are living in one European hotel after the next. And it's just I think just such a fraught but interesting time in 20th century history.
And in
I'm
terms of
loving
the
it.
series as a whole, firstly, do you kind of see it remaining centered around New York? And are there any time periods would you kind of go backwards before the setting of Irish Eyes, or is it kind
Like
of.
a prequel. I don't think I'll do a prequel. So Stardust, we're looking at 1930s and 1940s. And then the third book, Dream a Little Dream, will most likely be between New York and Hollywood.
Okay, I'm there.
So in the 1940s and early 1950s. So with that book, you will have the golden era of Hollywood. You'll have
Amazing.
all of the Hedda Hopper and all of the deliciously vile gossip columnists. You'll have people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, who are not the bright young thing anymore, trying to reinvent himself as a screenwriter. Dorothy Parker, same thing, in
Wow.
Hollywood, trying to reinvent herself as a screenwriter and actually succeeding. Then, of course, we'll slip into the dark days of Joseph McCarthy and the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare. So, a lot of fun history to play with
Amazing.
in all of these books.
Well, now I've got pretty high hopes for your novel evening because you're obviously researching deep. You've got lots of characters to pull on here. So I'm very excited. So we'll kick things off with where are we going to go for your evening?
Well, strap yourself in, Danny, because we are going back in time
Amazing.
to interwar Paris,
Oh,
the
okay.
Ritz Bar, which is now the Hemingway Bar. So I've already given away. We are going to go there, and it's going to be a hen party. No boys allowed. No
Nice.
sinking boys allowed. We are having Josephine Baker.
Oh, I mean, firstly, just to meet Josephine Baker, what would you even say?
I would just worship at her feet. I don't think I would probably be too
Don't think you could
fangirl
speak.
to speak.
Also, I
She's
want to know what she
amazing.
smelled like, which I know is really weird, but I bet she smelled in whatever perfume she
Amazing.
wore would have been incredible.
Well, I think she wore Chanel number five,
Did she?
interestingly enough. So I think she wore Chanel number five. We'll see if somebody is out there listening and knows otherwise, maybe they'll let us know. But I believe she wore Chanel number five. She was a terribly chic. She is emerging as a major character in Stardust with book two.
Amazing.
So we will have her. We will have Coco Chanel, not because I think Coco Chanel is a lovely person, but she is
Yeah.
an amusing person
She
and
frightens me a little
a
bit. I think I'd be a bit frightened of Coco.
Coco Chanel. Some of the things that have come out about her wartime activities are not, of course, as you know,
Not ideal.
complimentary.
Yeah.
But she'll be sort of our mean girl foil. And then I'm going to invite Sylvia Beach. I don't
Okay.
know how much of a drinker she was, but I love Sylvia Beach. She's also pretty substantial secondary character in Stardust. And I think it would be really interesting. And so the only boy in the room will be Frank Meyer, who was the
Okay.
head barman at the Ritz. Frank Meyer wrote an amazing book in 1936 called The Artistry of Mixing Drinks, which is about mixing drinks, but it's also about how to live life. You know, he's a
Oh.
philosopher bartender. He left again, left New York with prohibition. Can't be a bartender if there's no legal bar to tend. So he was hired to the Ritz Hotel in Paris, and he's going to be making Sazeracs and pink squirrels and all sorts of wonderful drinks, many of which he invented for our
Wow, I did not
ladies.
know that.
Yes, for our drinks, drinks for our ladies as they diss on the Paris scene. But you know, it again, such an interesting time. I mean, this little bar on the Rue Cambon side of the hotel. I mean, during the occupation, I mean, you've got Nazis staying at the hotel that which they requisitioned. You know, you've got Hermann Göring, you know, coming into the bar with his Cartier baton studded with diamonds that he had custom ordered. You know, you've got journalists like Martha Gellhorn. You've got, again, you know, these bored British and American socialites. You've got the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, you know, with a regular room there. I mean, crazy time. And you've got German spies, you've got spies for the De Gaulle's Free French and the French Resistance. And they're all in this tiny little bar, knocking back cocktails and trying to figure out how to stab one another in the back. And if I can't make a story of that, you know, I should just hang up my stirrups as a writer, because that is the bomb as far
Yeah.
as I'm concerned.
That is wow. I mean, it's just to get to be a fly on the wall during that time period and to overhear conversations that were being had and things that were happening, amazing. And what a
I think
group of
so
women to
too.
get to experience it with. I mean, a lot of fun.
And interestingly enough, they probably did cross paths. I know Josephine Baker loved haute couture, and she, I'm sure, shopped at Chanel occasionally. She also shopped at, you know, other designers later on. But just so interesting. And you know, we know of her, of the, you know, the entertainer and the trailblazer. But I mean, her work for the French Resistance, for the deuxième bureau, the French intelligence service, She had a pilot's license. She flew her own plane. She flew supplies in for the Red Cross. I mean, she got the French Legion of Honor awarded to her after the war. But I mean, just amazing. And so, America's loss was definitely France's gain.
And again, for a young black woman to travel to Europe, from America, my kids have a there's a series called Little People, Big Dreams, and they do books about various people through history and famous people. They're amazing for children. And they have a Josephine Baker book. They have all sorts. We have RuPaul and Dolly Parton and Elton John, and they're fantastic for kids. But I know Josephine Baker's her childhood was quite difficult as well. She really And she didn't just get an easy break. She hauled herself up. She worked her socks off in a time period that was very much against her, going over to Europe, going over to Paris, and making herself not only a sensation, but also putting her neck on the line. She really put herself in danger.
No, very much so. Amazing. And every time she would come back to America to do a tour, she would always sort of end up regretting it. I mean, the critics were horribly unkind to her. And then, eventually, when she locked heads with Walter Winchell, that was sort of the end of her in America. She didn't really come back much until she came back as an older woman to participate in the March on Washington with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Incredible.
And Bobby Kennedy, who was the attorney general, had to basically do some backdoor dealing to get her to even be allowed back into the country. I mean, so it was just I mean, she really, she put her neck out on the line, and I mean, she took some hits for standing up for what she believed was right.
And I think there's something to be said about at the time the American press, not being able to bear a success story because they'd kind of rejected her. So it was almost the fact she'd become this star elsewhere was almost too much to bear.
An international superstar, and one of the ways she was able to continue to help the French Resistance was after 1941, she continued to tour. And was in North Africa touring and passing on messages about troop movements and whatnot. I mean, amazing,
And she had,
amazing.
t I can't remember how many children she had, but she adopted, was it
I
12?
believe it was 12. She called them her rainbow tribe, and she, long before Angelina Jolie or Madonna started going and picking up children from various parts of the world, she was doing that. She felt very strongly that that people should live together in peace and harmony, and wanted both wanted to be a mother and wanted to give homes to children who'd been orphaned from war or hadn't had parents who were able to take care of them. And she did that in the south of France at her chateau, Les Moulins, with it wasn't a perfect situation and with mixed success, but some of her children write fondly of her, and others are more critical. Just like with our
That's mother.
biological
That's motherhood. I think that is the.
parents.
I think that is the truth. You're not always going to have the perfect. Even if you're Josephine Baker, you're not always going to have the perfect relationship. And she was a very busy woman as well. It's a very difficult juggle.
She worked very hard. She had a lot of debt, some of which was incurred from her incredible generosity of spirit of staging these entertainments for the troops and not really getting paid or reimbursed for that. So, and she liked the high life. So there was that as
Pet
well.
leopards and things are not easy to, or pet cheetah is not an easy pet to keep. My dog
I
costs me
bet they eat a
enough.
lot. I bet they eat a lot. So, but yeah, I am. I write a Substack called History with Hope, and I did a bit on Josephine Baker not too long ago. Coco Chanel and other folks like that.
Check it
So,
out. And we've
yeah.
kind of mentioned this is a girls only affair. But is there anyone you particularly don't want to show up to this evening?
Yes, I mean, suffice it to say, Hermann Göring is not invited, for sure. No, Ernest Hemingway. I am not really. I love his writing, but in terms of his personality, he's such a blowhard. He blew into Paris in 1944 and claimed to have liberated the Ritz Hotel, you know, after, of course, all the Nazis had already left and the American flag was all and the French tricolor was already hoisted on the ramparts, and proceeded to raid the wine cellar and get, you know,
As
wickedly
Hemingway
drunk.
did, yeah, that was
As he did. So yeah, I think he's a lot. I don't think any of the ladies, other than maybe Coco Chanel, would manage to get a word in edgewise if he were there. So I am he goes to the bad boy corner for sure.
I love the interpretation of him in Midnight in Paris by Corey Stoll. He's so dry and so just. His writing is beautiful, but also he just talks like he writes. And there's a time and a place to be able to curl up with a Hemingway. You don't need it talked at you all night.
Exactly. So, oh, that's a wonderful movie, though. Midnight in Paris is one of my
Same.
favorite
I love
films.
it. I think it's so cleverly done, and it made me want to be able to go back in time so badly and experience that. And I
Yeah.
love this evening. And I love the fact you've tied it in to what's going on with your next book.
Great. Well, I try.
You did it very well. This is a time I want to go back to. And before I let you go and enjoy the rest of your afternoon, I have to ask if you're reading anything at the moment.
I am. So I just finished, you know, a nonfiction book. I'm thick in the research of Stardust. So I'm not really allowing myself to read too many novels until after the book is into the publisher. But the book is Coco Chanel's Secret War, the Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War. And it's by the author is Hal Vaughn. That's Vaugh. The book came out in 2011, so it's not new, but Hal Vaughn, now deceased, sadly, was a very, very excellent wartime researcher. He unearthed a lot of intelligence about Coco Chanel that was sort of kind of maybe known, but not really known about her activities as a German spy. And he interviewed her niece, who was still living at the time. Gabrielle was named Gabrielle after her. Gabrielle Lebruni, and you know, a lot of the Chanel had biographers, of course, before, but a lot of them were sort of, you know, apologists for her, or you know, friends or acquaintances who kind of glossed over, you know, her wartime activities, you know, saying, you know, these were hard years, and certainly they were hard years, but I mean, she did more than what, you know, what you would say horizontally collaborating, you know, sleeping with a German, a Nazi, spy at the, who was also at the Ritz. She really went beyond that, you know, and then after the liberation of Paris, when so many women were called out for being horizontal collaborators, whether they all were or not, and they had their heads shaven and, you know, were paraded around. And I mean, it was, you know, it was like 10,000 women, you know, had their head shaven. It was not, you know, a one or two kind of thing. And, you know, Coco Chanel really skated by, and what she did was she self-exiled to Switzerland for 10 years and then came back to Paris, I think in 1954, and launched her first collection in 10 years, in 1955. But so she was a, you know, a beyond all, she was a survivor. And I mean, if you were in her good graces, you were golden for a while, but she was very manipulative. She was, you know, again, like Josephine Baker, had come from, you know, a very tough childhood situation. And you know, she was a tough, pragmatic survivor lady who did
Complex,
some
a
really not great
complex
things.
character to tackle. Amazing. That sounds fascinating, though, I have to
It's a
say.
terrific book. It's a terrific book. So, Coco Chanel's Secret War, Sleeping with the Enemy.
Amazing. Well, look, hope this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for coming and
Thank
sharing all about
you.
Irish Eyes. I have found it absolutely fascinating.
Thank
Love the
you.
book, and I cannot wait for book two.
Well, great. Unfortunately, you will not have to wait too long for Stardust. It will be out in August of 2024, wherever books are
Amazing.
sold.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Novel Evening. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed making it. Please remember to go over and rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check us out on Instagram at A Novel Evening Podcast and over on TikTok under the same name. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.